and welcome, history friends, patrons all, to our special series on my PhD thesis. Last time we began assessing the Opium War in its context, and here we continue with this analysis while looking at a similar situation in Afghanistan. How was national honour used in these circumstances, both to justify the government's policy and to aid the opposition's effort to undermine this campaign? We also looked at the honour script, which, if you need a bit of a refresher, was just an idea proposed by Avner Offer, a historian, which suggests that national honour contained an inner logic and formula which dictated how it worked and what it demanded with rigid consistency. It deserves further investigation, but here we bring this Opium War to an end with important conclusions on how the ethic worked and even how political opponents could succumb to its pull. We've got a lot to get through today, as you can see from the length of this thing, so without any further ado, I will now take you back to Chapter 2 of my thesis. Chapter 2, Part 1. Insult, Immorality, and Vindication in Asia, 1839-1842. Continued. The importance of adhering to the honour script by repelling insults and asserting Britain's position was thus plain. Without this adherence, other lesser powers would take advantage of perceived weakness. One could argue that another aspect of vindication was the act of reminding the Chinese of British power, so they would not underestimate or disrespect it in the future. The Tories were attacked for their cynicism and inconsistency. Was it really credible to suggest that if the government absorbed the insult, they would have been satisfied? Allied to the charge of dishonourable mismanagement was that of immorality, which reminded the public of the detestable opium trade. When independent peer Earl Stanhope chaired a London meeting, he attacked the war as one of the most flagitious, unjust, and disgraceful that had ever been entered into, insisting that if it continued, we should have no ground of complaint against France, or any other nation, for want of faith. According to this view, Britain would incur shame if she fought a war for opium, and such shame would damage national honour as severely as the perceived failure to respond to insult. Other sources, particularly of Anglo-Indian origin, were more belligerent. However, this pro-war position was undermined by those ministers and their allies who contended that war was not declared and would only occur if the Chinese did not peacefully submit to the demands of the military expedition. However unlikely this possibility, ministers could publicly cling to it while preparing for war. This facade was maintained into the summer of 1840 as parliamentary questions pertaining to letters of marque, the cost of the expedition, its composition and leadership, the role of opium in the war, and the possibility of banning it were all similarly disposed of by claiming that it depended on how the Chinese reacted. Even when an order in council permitted the seizure of all shipping on the Chinese coast, Palmerston asserted that the distance of the theatre excused the government for planning for every contingency. In July, the Commons approved war credits of £173,000, despite the state of war not technically existing. By then, British and Empire soldiers had begun their first campaign for the Chusan Archipelago. Indeed, after the initial controversy, the conflict with China moved to the background and was rarely discussed in Parliament. The government's survival of Graham's motion granted de facto sanction to the war, and Peel's new administration, in August 1841, pursued the war to the end. Still, the claim that the war had been launched to vindicate British honour proved durable. Members later rejoiced in military victories, and there was room even to commend the soldiery for not reverting to dishonourable excess in their quest for vindication. Others, like the Duke of Wellington, maintained that they would always support a British government which fought for British rights and honour. Furthermore, the opium trade and the impossibility of suppressing it was retroactively conceded by Peel's government. Much was made of the need to demonstrate British power to the Chinese, and inculcate within them a respect for British prestige which their inherent barbarism made it otherwise impossible to comprehend. Since it could conceivably be claimed that Britain did not desire a war of conquest with China and sought only the vindication of its honour, members were compelled to support this vindication. The conflict subsequently developed into precisely such a war for conquest, as Chinese cities were bombarded and land was seized, but the mission of vindication, possible only through a satisfactory treaty, remained in the forefront. "We are unfortunately still engaged in hostilities with the Chinese Empire," said the Earl of March in early 1842, "but such a war could not be avoided without compromising our national honour." The Sino-British relationship was in this sense a useful tool, as several decades of resentment could be drawn upon where Captain Elliot's treatment was presented as the final straw in a litany of insults. Public knowledge and outcry over the opium trade was palpable, yet even this moral dilemma could not intrude upon the necessity of vindication. The rhetoric of honour was thus a valuable tool in the government's arsenal, but it was one tool among many, featuring alongside the vagueness of the war aims and the imperatives of secure commercial relations. Thus, it may be argued that while Melanchthon's identification of national honour as the cause of the war was ultimately perhaps overstretched, the ethic did provide ministerial unity and granted access to a rhetorical well which did not necessarily have to resonate with the public to distract from government failure or obfuscation. The appeal to national honour, Melanchthon discerned, neatly tied together the interests of state and the political interests of the cabinet. Conversely, it should be noted that this appeal to national honour was underwhelming, particularly in comparison to other campaigns for vindication. No ministers made public speeches in support of the war during the critical months of spring and summer 1840, save for those made in Parliament, and the general tone of the media suggests that the country had become resigned to the requirements of the honour script, rather than jubilant about the prospects of a war of vindication. This may be explained by the murkiness of available documentation and the widely publicised evils of opium, which remained open to criticism. Still, the necessity of vindication in a region so close to India was never seriously challenged. This may have been a pragmatic decision, since the punitive expedition to China amounted to a fait accompli and could not be stopped once launched. It proved the first in a succession of reinforcements which enabled British and Empire forces to inflict several crushing defeats. The cloak of glory and the passage of time moved the conflict beyond its original parameters, to make the Chinese sensible of the extent of the outrage they had committed. China was forced to pay compensation both for the seized opium and for the expenses Britain incurred waging war against it. The quest of vindication was brought to the forefront, refining the original casus belli, while the commitment to seize no territory was ignored, an inconsistency which Palmerston, by then in opposition, justified in the then jubilant mood. Even from opposition, Russell could use the rhetoric of honour to reassert the necessity of seeking satisfaction, a task which had only led to war because of Chinese intransigence. This necessity may have granted the government a degree of plausible deniability, though contemporaries arguably saw through such claims. Significantly, this use of rhetoric was not confined to the Chinese example. A brief contrast with the concurrent crisis in Afghanistan may be instructive. Although initially successful in establishing an Anglophile regime in Kabul, by early 1842 the situation collapsed and Britain suffered a defeat equaled only by Isandlwana in 1879. Britons were aghast at the perceived betrayal of their puppet regime, the imprisonment of civilians and the destruction of a British regiment, which were presented through the lens of national honour. Unlike the resignation which greeted news from China, Britons anxiously followed news of the Afghan debacle, to the extent that the Kabul campaign has been regarded as an early example of a media war. Upon learning of the catastrophe in spring 1842, Peel's Conservatives emphasised the importance of responding to insult, in language not dissimilar to that used by the Whigs, following news of Captain Elliot's detention. However, the Afghan insult was arguably more severe since it contained the unprecedented destruction of a British column. British military honour necessitated a swift response, and it would have been politically impossible to abandon the theatre without acquiring the appropriate satisfaction. The honour script demanded immediate satisfaction and gelled with the necessity of vindication for reasons of prestige, Indian security, and imperial interests. If honour was not vindicated, the disaster could be viewed as a fatal symptom of British weakness rather than a singular event. It was markedly more difficult to defy the honour script when facing such a stark military defeat, nor was there room for forbearance when facing offences from these uncivilized powers. This intolerance towards insults from a non-European theatre was consistent with the general train of Victorian policy. Suffering an insult from an uncivilized power was not merely unpalatable, it also threatened British presentations of its empire and world power status. The rhetoric of national honour associated colonial defeat with imperial instability through anxious, urgent language which contemporaries understood and professed to believe in. One discerns that insults from France, the United States, and even Spain were subject to negotiation, whereas regions susceptible to imperial expansion demanded immediate military retaliation. In the Chinese case, Melanchthon argued that economic interests were only part of a larger, complex set of motivations in the decision-making process. The most important motive was honour. Yet, one could argue that economic imperatives were aided by the appeal to honour, and that the prospect of stable trade relations, twinned with financial compensation, were incentives which informed the cabinet's decision to deploy the ethic. The likelihood of victory may have influenced this policy, alongside an inherent racism and sense of entitlement which balked at placing Asian rights on a parity with Britain's. Additionally, it may be argued that the goals of restoring equal trading relations with China or establishing a favourable buffer state in Afghanistan were articulated through the rhetoric of honour to detract from criticism and cynicism. Such tactics did not shield ministers from scrutiny, but they provided a viable rhetorical framework which excused any misgivings for the sake of national honour. Like the Chinese case, critics condemned the immorality of the Afghan policy which had facilitated these disasters in the first place. Parrying such charges, ministers warned of the danger to India which would follow if national honour was not vindicated in Kabul, mirroring the concerns of the East India Company towards China. Yet, some challenged, was it not ludicrous to claim that Britain's unrivalled position could be threatened by such middling powers? Indeed, the inherent brittleness this suggested in Britain's Indian influence moved Benjamin Disraeli to challenge the logic of such a sensitive prestige, a significant contribution considering his later behaviour during the Eastern Crisis. When a successful Afghan campaign technically redeemed the previous defeat, in late September 1842, there was still room to condemn the excess of soldiers on the ground in Kabul, who raised the sight of the betrayal in the city's bazaar. Critics maintained that immoral conduct in both China and Afghanistan undermined the claim to satisfaction. Afghans would remember Britain's character for excess, it was claimed, far more than the spectacle of triumph. It was also argued that British immorality would make evangelizing more difficult in these regions in the future. Yet, the Chinese and Afghan cases also show how the vindication of honour could overcome objections both to the policy's conception and to the government's subsequent conduct. It seemed what mattered most was that because of these campaigns, honour had been retrieved. When news of the Afghan triumph reached London in December 1842, it was cause for satisfaction. Peel insisted that it was impossible to contemplate these services without feeling proud of the British name. The Prime Minister congratulated members that, while we were thus vindicating the honour of the British name in the northwest of India, a campaign of consummate skill was underway in China. Considering such effective campaigning, Sir Robert Peel declared himself willing to believe that these unquestionable proofs of the military reputation of England notwithstanding the long interval of peace, stands as high as it did during the excitement of the war. Parliament voted its thanks for both triumphs in a dedicated session, and advocates of retributive justice turned to asserting the necessity of vindication. According to the standards of the honour script, by its victory in Kabul, the government had restored the British name, a synonym of prestige. Even in opposition, Lord John Russell contended that favourable results would follow this vindication of honour. Critics were required to focus on the finer details of the situation in their attacks. Indian Governor-General, the Earl of Ellenborough, may have been upheld as the successful vindicator of our honour, but Whig critics emphasised his personal negligence, just as Tories had charged Melbourne's government with imperilling national honour in China through similar negligence. Explanation for the Opium War was reduced to a response to insult, and similarly, Peel could declare that the insult has been avenged when reflecting on the campaign in Kabul. Ultimately, the rhetoric of honour boasted a political resonance which added to its effectiveness. One discerns that in Afghanistan and China, divisions existed among Tories, Whigs, Liberals, Radicals and Irish MPs, rooted in the interpretation of what national honour required and where it resided. Visible even within political parties, this manifested in a striking spectacle where members criticised their own government and used their understanding of national honour to do so. This illustrated not merely the magnitude of the task of persuasion, but also the inherent difficulty of gathering political support for a contentious policy. Governments struggled under scrutiny levelled from the opposition and backbenchers, but there were reasons for pushing through these obstacles and pursuing one's goals to fruition. Critics could impugn dishonourable conduct, but if said conduct brought a triumphant outcome, it was politically difficult to condemn an administration which had overseen the fulfilment of national honour's demands. After all, it was established that the government was duty-bound to defend national honour wherever it was impugned. This, perhaps, was the key to national honour's rhetorical and ideological power. It was difficult to educate the public on the nuances of the opium trade or the strategic importance of erecting a buffer state in Afghanistan against Russian encroachment to India, but the rhetoric of honour provided a familiar language which, at its core, justified military intervention. As Palmerston understood, whenever events may call for the display of our military or naval power to maintain the interests or vindicate the honour of the country, then the army and navy of Great Britain will be found as they have ever been, fully equal to the maintenance of those interests or the vindication of that honour. National honour was also a convenient tool in moments of crisis. One discerns that in comparison with other cases, the government's victories in Afghanistan and China amounted to making the best of a dangerous situation. In both instances, ministers were taken by surprise and then driven to respond by the expectations established by the honour script. British honour, British influence over India, and Britain's prestige across the world required a show of force. The ethic facilitated what would otherwise have been an impossible policy hastily adopted by a beleaguered government, presented to an unsympathetic parliament, and followed by a mostly uninterested public. I think it's fair to say that national honour, although a belief system, was also recognised by now as a useful tool which could aid the government's policy. As the radically inclined Whig Benjamin Hawes asserted in April 1840, if the national honour was not to be indicated from injury and insult, then he must say that one of the greatest misfortunes which could befall would occur to this country, as its very existence in Asia and Europe depended upon its conduct in this critical and difficult emergency. Benjamin Hawes asserted that Britain did not seek conquest or extent of dominion. Her object was not aggression nor aggrandizement. All she sought was reparation from insult and injury. Finally, Hawes asserted that the country and the merchants felt that insults to British subjects were not to be slightly committed, especially in India, where Britain was powerful more by her moral than by her physical influence. This messaging was maintained by former ministers even after they had left office. In 1842, Lord John Russell from the opposition benches reminded members that the purpose of the expedition to China had been to resent insults and injuries offered to Her Majesty's officers and Her Majesty's subjects, but that if the terms which were originally proposed by Her Majesty's representative had been acceded to by the Chinese, full satisfaction would have been afforded us. However, as that reparation was refused, instructions were given for the attack of the defences on the Chinese coast. The island of Chusan and several towns were taken by our troops, and a portion of the Chinese forces were destroyed. Russell insisted that this was the course to which we had been compelled to resort to obtain reparation for the insults and injuries offered to us as a nation. Where the opposition did not accept this fact in 1840, pro-government press organs were on hand to criticise them for their cynicism. Edinburgh's Caledonian Mercury newspaper noted that as soon as war was made against the Chinese, the ensign of national honour was lowered and the dirty yellow flag of faction hoisted, while the bold warlike defiance of the Tories sank into a womanly treble for peace, peace at all hazards. It observed that if Lord Melbourne and his colleagues had been passive under all the insults of the Chinese, then the cry would have been that the government was laying the country prostrate before them. Yet, when the cabinet remonstrances in defence of the nation's rights, then they are accused of thirsting for war. To explain this need for vindication, some papers reflected on the years of insults inflicted by the Chinese, which convinced them that Britain would never repel future insults, however severe. Thus, the weekly liberal paper, The Era, asked, "How is it that so long a period has not been sufficient to make the Chinese acknowledge our superiority?" The reason was plain. We have permitted them to treat us with insult and indignity, because in every disagreement we have invariably submitted to their dictation and bowed to their despotism. It is as true between nations as it is between individuals, that those will never obtain respect who do not respect themselves. The Era considered that while the casus belli with the Chinese before 1839 was clear, our national honour demanded it, and all scruples of conscience would have been removed. Now, there is such a strange jumble of interests and wrongs, fair and illicit trading, that it has become a question on which the disputant on either side may alternatively claim the victory. Yet, concluding its case, if the grounds of the war are in the present instance trifling, this did not necessarily matter, as it must not be forgotten that we had a long series of insult and indignity to strengthen it, while the promised results would be very beneficial to the human race. China was one issue, but it is certainly interesting to see how the Tories reacted to the Afghan insult when they were in power. The sheer scale of the defeat in Kabul in early 1842 certainly shocked British opinion, but once they had collected themselves, it was business as usual in seeking satisfaction and reasserting British prestige in Afghanistan. As the former Governor General for India and architect of the Afghan War, the Earl of Auckland, explained, he invaded Afghanistan because he considered it essential to the safety of our empire in India, because he saw a danger approaching the Indian territory, which would have left us without power, without stability, without safety. It was only after painful deliberation and close consultation with informed agents that the Earl of Auckland resolved at once to dispel the danger which was most imminent, and which danger he firmly believed could now be represented as no longer formidable, solely because that decisive step had been taken. But just as some radical MPs challenged the motive for war with China, the Conservatives were challenged both for their justification of war with Afghanistan and their conduct in that war. The radical and free trader Dr. John Bowring, later to serve as consul of Canton, considered the Afghan war from first to last anything but honourable to our national character, since we had little to be proud of in the invasion of a country of which we had nothing to complain. Not to be outdone, Bowring's fellow radical John Roebuck challenged the House of Commons to show him anything so degrading to English honour and honesty as our conduct with respect to India. He added, "You are afraid of the powerful, and therefore you generously and gallantly attack the weak. In the whole series of unjust wars, I defy you to show me anything so degrading as this to British honesty and honour." He challenged the notion that because we have a strong enemy, are we to do injustice to a weak friend? Exclaiming that we fear Russia on the Caspian and we crush Dost Muhammad in Kabul. Joseph Hume, the radical Irish MP for Kilkenny, great place by the way, reflected that although he was not one that discredited the Afghan war, yet he could not say that the conduct of affairs there reflected any credit upon us. Indeed, Hume regretted that as they withdrew, British soldiers had left indelible marks on our character which would last as long as many who then heard him lived. Hume was certain that, having redeemed our military character, which was of much more importance than many supposed, we ought to have retired with magnanimity. And since the authors of the treachery, which had once facilitated the destruction of her army in Afghanistan, could not be found when the British arrived there, Hume believed that we ought to have left without revenging ourselves upon the innocent population. The destruction of Kabul's bazaar, Hume declared, was an act so barbarous that he could not find anything like it even in the conduct of the Goths. Nor were radicals and Irish the only forces opposing the Afghan campaign. Remarkably, considering his later pursuit of a still more disastrous invasion of Afghanistan in late 1878, none other than Benjamin Disraeli opposed the war, distinguishing himself from his peers as he did so. Disraeli discerned that the Afghan war had been launched to restore Indian confidence in British power, yet he really did hope that in these hard, dry, matter-of-fact, income tax days, statesmen would be prepared to offer some more substantial reasons for their policy than the expediency of restoring confidence in our star. Disraeli added, if he believed that confidence in our star alone or principally constituted the tenure by which we held India, we should despair of holding that country for any considerable period. And so far from being of opinion that our empire in India was one easily to be shaken, he believed on the contrary it was maintained by a power not inferior to that by which any existing authority maintained its rule. Disraeli presented the view that British influence in India could withstand a defeat which would, to a certain extent, perhaps sully the character of our arms, adding that if our empire in India could be shaken or even endangered by such a defeat, he must conclude that we held our sway by a very feeble and fragile tenure. But the fact of victory in Kabul and China had a way of overcoming such opposition and enabling contemporaries on both sides to bask in the glory. The conservative Viscount Courtenay reflected that the Afghan war, a war maintained in a country of peculiar difficulty against foes of unknown numbers and unascertained resources, against the machinations of unparalleled treachery, could be a source of great satisfaction, as Britons could see, that the honour of the British name has been vindicated and the superiority of the British arms established on the scenes of our former reverses. Courtenay reasoned that if the government continue to show themselves ready and anxious to maintain peace at the risk of everything but national honour, then it would receive and deserve the confidence of a portion of the country. Even Lord John Russell now felt the utmost confidence that these gallant exploits are a proof that every interest in England will be maintained and that English honour will be vindicated in whatever quarter of the globe it may be infringed or violated. While rejoicing most sincerely in the success of our arms in Afghanistan, and being delighted that the honour of British arms has been re-established, Russell believed, we are only beginning to see the good consequences of the invasion of Afghanistan, which would contrast British influence favourably with native Indian princes. Clearly then, policymakers were hampered by opposition even when they brought forward the rhetoric of honour in their arguments. By far the most effective argument was military victory, and this enabled members to retroactively justify both the Chinese and Afghan campaigns. This was the beginning of British expansion into China, and was also arguably the beginning of the Century of Humiliation, which remains a prescient part of Chinese national memory to this day. Both China and Afghanistan would reappear in the future, and the motives for making war there again, as we will see, were always consistent with national honour. National honour cut through the moral and political opposition, especially since the opium trade was roundly unpopular in British opinion. The best way to overcome this difficulty was to recast the conflict as one in the name of national honour, rather than a drug trade. And if it is true that Glenn Milankin overstated national honour as a motive for the Opium War, I would argue that the language accompanying national honour made intervention easier. Similarly, in Afghanistan, while prestige and the fate of the hostages were pressing concerns, the act of reasserting British supremacy and sending a message to Russia were also strong motives. Had contemporaries been strictly honest, the discourse might have looked very different, but we know by now that these individuals were well aware of national honour's mobilising power and its ability to cut through difficult arguments while resonating with the public. In the next episode, we'll look at a situation which was apparently ripe for the deployment of this honour-based language, an intolerable insult inflicted by the ungrateful government of Spain. I hope you'll join me for that, my dear history friend, but until then, thank you so much for listening and supporting. It really makes a difference. Until next time, though, my name is Zach, and I'll be seeing you all soon.